Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The mass shooting at an Orlando nightclub early Sunday has reignited the debate over semi-automatic assault-style rifles. In 1994, an assault weapons ban was signed into law by President Bill Clinton. A Republican-controlled Congress permitted the ban to expire a decade later. Now, every time another semi-automatic assault-style rifle is used in a mass killing at an elementary school in Connecticut, a movie theater in Colorado, an office party in San Bernardino, and a nightclub in Orlando, the horror triggers the call for another ban. Coming up, we'll hear from gun rights advocates and recall previous efforts to ban assault-style semi-automatic firearms. Joining us now is journalist Matt Valentine. He has written on gun violence and gun policy for The Atlantic, Salon, and most recently, Politico. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks.
Orlando police first identified the weapon used in the rampage there as an AR-15 type assault rifle. On Monday, officials said the weapon used was a Sig Sauer MCX. Both weapons can fire the same type of ammunition at roughly the same speeds and share a similar history. What kind of history are we talking about here?
Well, the AR-15 is a rifle that was developed originally for the military, and then evolutions of that rifle sort of put it on two separate tracks. There was the M16, which has been pretty much standard equipment for our military for most of the past several decades, and variations of that rifle have been used by the military. And the civilian version, which is semi-automatic, which, the original carried the designation AR-15. This rifle has had a lot of other designations and has been manufactured by several different gun makers. But it's essentially, just a semi-automatic version of what our troops carry in combat. It uses a 30-round magazine, and this was standardized in all NATO countries sort of accepted the same specifications for magazine. And that same magazine is used in both the AR-15 and the SIG MCX, which is the rifle used in Orlando. So they have identical magazines with a 30-round capacity, which is really the most significant factor in sort of the severity of these mass shootings.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the issue of semi-automatic weaponry, rifle, firearms this hour in light of the latest mass killing using semi-automatic equipment. My guest right now, Matt Valentine, he's a journalist. He's written most recently on this issue for Politico. We'll have a link to his story on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question about this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. So, Matt Valentine, what's the difference between an automatic and a semi-automatic?
Well, an automatic weapon will continue to fire when you hold your finger down on the trigger. And a semi-automatic, you have to pull the trigger each time you want to fire a bullet with your finger. So, in some applications, the military uses fully automatic fire, but all of the sort of standard rifles that our troops carry, the M16 version is what we call select fire, mm-hmm. which means it can either be fully automatic or it could be semi-automatic. When it's switched to semi-automatic, it's basically the same weapon as the AR-15. And the military actually recommends using semi-automatic in a lot of combat situations. That allows people to shoot accurately and relatively quickly. And there's not, I think a lot of attention is paid to this difference. And gun rights activists are frustrated when people use the word automatic weapon when they're really talking about a semi-automatic weapon. Mm-hmm. And I understand that frustration about terminology, the point is that you can fire a lot of bullets fairly quickly from a semi-automatic rifle, which is what we see in these incidents.
Because pulling the trigger isn't that rigorous, right?
No, in fact, there are you can modify these semi-automatic weapons with a special stock that's legal that actually sort of allows the recoil of the rifle to move it back and forth in your arm. And if you keep your finger rigid, it basically, you know, instead of your finger pulling the trigger kind of bumps itself into your finger. It's called bump fire. And with that modification, a semi-automatic rifle really has the same rate of fire as an automatic weapon. And that's completely legal. That wasn't, as far as we know, that wasn't the modification. That modification wasn't used in the Orlando shooting. But just to sort of clarify the point that this is a sort of a distinction without a difference between semi-automatic and automatic.
The headline for your recent piece for Politico called the AR-15 the most political gun in America. Why did it use that phraseology?
Well, the AR-15 has really sort of become symbolic of the intractability of the debate over guns. You know, gun rights advocates and gun control advocates end up, you know, since we're not really talking about banning all guns, the question is, where do we draw the line? And a lot of people feel like maybe the line should be drawn somewhere in proximity to the types of weapons that are actually being used in these high-profile mass shootings, which are often AR-15s or similar rifles. And you know, the gun rights community really rejects that notion, and we see a lot of conservative, sort of gun-friendly politicians really embrace the AR-15. You know. Somebody challenged Lindsey Graham at a town hall meeting last year about his commitment to the Second Amendment, and Graham's response was, "Come to my house, I'll show you my AR-15," as if that just ownership of an AR-15 was sort of a bona fide of your commitment to mm-hmm. the Second Amendment. We saw Ted Cruz wrap raw bacon around the muzzle of an AR-15. And fire it rapidly until it cooked the bacon, because, you know, he was sort of demonstrating that he's enthusiastic about guns.
Wait, he really did that?
He did. Yes, he did that. There's a video of Ted Cruz eating bacon that he cooked off the hot muzzle of an AR-15, cooked with the heat of rapid fire.
So the gun lobby says that a compromise is out of the question. Why?
Well, the argument that they tend to use when we talk about an assault weapons ban or a magazine capacity restriction is that it wouldn't really make any difference. Is that's their contention. You know, these assault weapons bans ultimately are about magazine capacity. You have semi-automatic weapons with high capacity magazines. Those are the types of weapons that tend to get categorized as assault weapons. And what gun enthusiasts will say is that, you know, what difference does it make if you have a 30-round magazine or 3 10-round magazines? You can just eject an empty magazine and pop a new one in a matter of a second or two. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, that doesn't make any difference, so why ban it? But in fact, it has made a difference in some instances. There was a mass shooting on the Long Island Railroad in 1993, and that ended when the perpetrator was exchanging a spent magazine for a fresh, fully loaded magazine. In that momentary pause, passengers on the plane intervened. They stopped him. They tackled him. Same thing happened in Thurston High School shooting in 1998. The shooter had a magazine that he emptied, and then he was trying to put in a new magazine, and was stopped by students at that high school who used that momentary pause as an opportunity to intervene. The Tucson shooting in 2011, that shooter had a extended magazine for a handgun. He had a 30-round magazine for the handgun, but when it was empty, he had a second magazine and was trying to load that second magazine into the gun when unarmed civilians took that momentary pause as their opportunity to get in there and stop him. So, it there are examples of incidents where magazine capacity has really been the determinative factor in ending a mass shooting. And it obviously, if that magazine is larger, it's going to be a longer, period of shooting, a longer spree of shooting before that pause happens and that opportunity is available.
How many of these style of semi-automatic firearms are out there? Do we even know?
Well, we don't know precisely because there's really no sort of nationally representative and comprehensive data keeping on firearm sales. We can look at the number of background checks that are performed as a rough estimate of how many gun sales are taking place in the country, and we can try to put together sales data, from manufacturers. But as I said, there are a lot of manufacturers making similar rifles. And, all we're really able to say is that these rifles seem to be the most popular guns in the country and that they're being sold in the millions.
Yeah, I was surprised that it's the most popular gun in the country because it's not, what's it typically used for? I mean, there aren't that many mass shootings. There's more than any other country in the world. But, be that as it may, I mean, there aren't that many. So what are people using them for?
Yeah, well, people, of course, the vast majority of people buying these weapons don't intend to commit any violence.
Of course not, yeah.
They're used recreationally. They're used for target shooting. I mean, I have memberships at a couple of gun clubs here in Texas where I live.
Uh-huh.
Every time I go to the gun range, I see most of the people in the booth have an AR-15 or similar rifle, and they're shooting targets with them.
What's fun about that compared to other sorts of firearms? Is there a consensus on that? I mean, I'm going to have an NRA instructor and training coordinator from Buckeye Firearms come on, but I'm curious, what do you hear people talking about?
Well, I mean, they are fun to shoot. They are reasonably accurate, which is important if you're trying to, develop your marksmanship skills.
Kind of like a good golf club, right?
Yeah. And the ammunition is less expensive than some other options, right? There are other rifles that use larger caliber bullets that are more expensive. So if you're going to shoot a lot of rounds, it can be more economical to do it with an AR-15 than with, like a 30-06 or something like that. And I think that part of the appeal is that they're customizable as well. People are able to add accessories to them. I get mailings in my mailbox every November is full of brochures from gun retailers that are, suggesting that people should buy as stocking stuffers, accessories for these AR-15.
Like what kind of accessories?
Flashlights that can be attached to them so that, you could use them in the dark, or optics. Scopes, things like that, that are designed specifically to be, compatible with the mounting on an AR-15, and people can exchange, you can change the stock, they can change the barrel, they can change the ergonomics of the rifle, and I think those things are appealing to consumers, and I also think that part of the allure, honestly, is that the rifles are similar to, or at least in appearance and realistically also in function, to rifles that are used in the military. And so they feel like they're connected in some way to that sort of.
Yeah, I read that they're very popular among veterans because there's something that they're real familiar with shooting.
Yeah, if you've been trained to use an M4 or an M16 rifle, then you would be very familiar with the layout of an AR-15. The controls would all be in the same place. And for what it's worth, the Sig Sauer MCX is similar in the way that it has its controls laid out. So you'd get, someone familiar with an AR-15 would be able to pick up that Sig Sauer and use it without needing to get really familiar with it.
When there's things like the Olympics, when they do that, and they have, shooting, whatever they call it, can't remember the actual sport title, but when they have
there are a couple of different shooting events in the Olympics. In the Winter Olympics, we have the biathlon, and then in the Summer Olympics, there are shotgun shooting sports like skeet.
Okay, so these aren't the kind of guns they'd use like in the Olympics then?
No.
Okay. Well, Matt Valentine, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you.
Matt Valentine is a journalist, freelance journalist. His latest piece on gun policy appeared in Politico. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll continue our conversation about the semi-automatic weaponry popular among gun enthusiasts in the United States now, the most popular gun in the United States. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Semi-automatic assault-style rifles are known notoriously as the weapons of preference in mass shootings, most recently when a lone gunman slaughtered 49 people early Sunday at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. Gun control advocates want a lot of things, but at least a return to a ban on these types of weapons. President Bill Clinton signed into law such a ban in 1994, and the GOP-controlled Congress left the ban to expire in 2004. We wanted to talk with an expert who's familiar with this type of firearm to learn more about how it works and why it's so popular among gun enthusiasts. Joining us by phone is National Rifle Association certified instructor and training coordinator for Buckeye Firearms Association, Clint Lake. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
So the Orlando shooter was originally reported to have used an AR-15 type assault rifle. Later it was clarified that he used a Sig Sauer MCX. People not familiar with firearms have heard terms like M16 and AK-47. What is it ultimately that distinguishes these type of weapons? What makes them work the way they do?
Well, when you say assault rifle, that goes back many years, and essentially there is some type of selector function on true assault rifles that enable it to fire in semi-automatic mode, meaning one trigger pull, one bullet. And if you move the selector switch to another position, it allows you for full automatic, which means that with one trigger pull, you get as many cartridges that are in the magazine that it holds until it's empty. In probably the last 20 years, there's been a third function of that selector switch, and it's called burst function, which gives you three cartridges with one trigger pull. Everything that's available for civilian purchase is semi-automatic. Our selector switch has two options, no fire and fire semi-automatic. So when folks say assault rifles have been banned since 1933-34. You can't purchase them, but it requires heavy governmental red tape and restrictions, and it costs a lot of money to buy a fully automatic assault rifle. Now, the rifles we have look like they're assault rifle equivalents, but they function totally different.
I read when I was reading about these, it said that they're gas-powered. Am I getting that wrong?
The mode of operation of both rifles, an AR-15 and M16 are gas powered, which means that when the bullet goes down the barrel, there's little holes in the barrel that port some of that gas that's behind the bullet up through a tube, and that tube then pushes that gas so that the bolt ejects the shell casing and loads a new one. So that's called gas impinged, and that's how it operates. You also have systems like the AK-47, which uses a piston where the gas pushes on the piston and the piston pushes on the bolt and the bolt extracts and reloads.
Okay, so that has more to do with reloading than it has to do with the velocity of the bullet.
Yes.
And you said that assault full assault weapons were banned in 1933 and 34. Was that sort of like that Tommy gun kind of a thing that we during the, you know, the Depression and that sort of thing?
Yes, it arose from the Prohibition. The gangs that arose after Prohibition, they used Tommy guns and sawed-off shotguns and sawed-off Browning automatic rifles during that period. So the government stepped on that and decided, you know, to ban those for civilian purchase. And we've been under that law ever since.
Why was the semi-automatic developed? We just heard from Matt Valentine, who wrote the piece for Politico, and he said that that's actually the semi-automatic, even though the fully automatic is used by the military, even the military prefers the semi-automatic.
The military prefers, they really don't like the full automatic because it's a high rate of fire and your magazine goes empty in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. What they do prefer is a 3-round burst. Military, I have numerous friends who have worked in for high elite units of the military. They actually prefer the three round burst because it provides them a little bit better control and puts rounds on target faster. But toward the civilian side, you know, we've been dealing with semi-automatics ever since, you know, the Colt revolver of the late 1800s.
Okay.
You know, so it operates as semi-automatic as well as, you know, as semi-automatic as the AR is today for us.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're learning more about what a semi-automatic weapon is. We do know that it's at the crux of an ongoing political battle in Washington over banning it has so far not succeeded. It used to be banned until 2004, when Congress let the 1994 ban signed into law by President Clinton expire. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Clint Lake. He's a certified NRA instructor and training coordinator at Buckeye Firearms Association. Brian in Whitehall, you're on the air. Hi, Brian.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Your prior guest was spot on. I'm a combat vet, Army, 8 years, and they relentlessly train you to be very, very familiar with your weapon system.
Sure.
And the thing is that what I have to really emphasize, yes, we have these kinds of tragedies happen, but this guy went through extensive background checks down in Orlando, and how did he get through there? Now, and I'm going to leave you with this, if we didn't have a Second Amendment, you wouldn't have a First Amendment. Let's be honest about that.
Let me ask you,
forthright.
Brian, let me ask you, because we were talking earlier that they are popular with combat veterans. Is that where you were introduced to this kind of weapon?
I was introduced to this weapon system back in 1983, and I spent 4 years in, 4 years out, and I re-enlisted to go to Iraq in 90. And it's just something you can't forget. It's
right.
Just ingrained in you. That's, you know, they extensively and intensively train you, you know, how to tear the weapon down, this, that, and the other. But I will say this, when it comes to the AK-47, it's even easier to break down. And that thing, you can run it over with a tank and it'll still work.
Huh.
An M16, a little bit of sand, and it tends to jam.
Are you a gun enthusiast since your service in the military?
I am, but I'm not. I mean, I have, you know, a little bit, you know, that's my right as an American
citizen. Sure, yeah.
But I don't go out of my way for that. I just basically go do target practice.
Okay. All right. Well, Matt, Brian.
It's good to keep up, you know, on the skills that you've been trained in.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, like I said before, if you didn't have a Second Amendment, you damn sure wouldn't have a First Amendment.
All right. Brian, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate your time.
Yes, ma'am.
614-292-8513 if you have a question or comment. Clint Lake, it's interesting to hear Brian talk about how carefully and extensively trained you are when you're in the military to use this kind of weaponry. And it makes sense that it's something that it's popular with people when they get out.
Absolutely. I see in my training events that I hold for Buckeye Firearms, which have been growing leaps and bounds for the last 3-4 years, so much so that I've added an intro to tactical carbine and advanced tactical carbine, you know, just one-day classes, because I saw the need for this, because people were buying rifles such as, you know, the semi-automatic version of the AR-15, and, you know, they were panic buying. They're afraid that the government was going to restrict the purchase of it, restrict the purchase of the type, and so they wanted to have one and just in case. And as a training coordinator, I wanted to get them skilled in the safety, cleaning, maintenance, firing, and carrying of that rifle. So, you know, I developed these programs, and they've been selling out for the last 2-3 years.
Right. Well, which it makes sense, because I frankly didn't realize, when I imagine people going out and buying guns, people who are afraid of that they were going to be cut off from access to guns, I always kind of pictured them going out and buying the guns they put under their pillow thing at night, but I was dead wrong. Now, let me ask you this. How easy is it to use one of these weapons? It, you know, when we hear about these people who go buy them and a few days later they go out and they use them in this horrible way, it sounds like they're pretty easy to use. Is that the case?
Well, in all truth, any firearm is generally pretty easy to use. They come with pretty good user manuals.
Mm-hmm.
They describe, you know, how to load and load clean and you know, modify the firearm. So, you know, it's not like you're driving, you know, a B-1 bomber or anything.
Okay.
By its very nature, it's pretty simple. There's ways to unload it, you know, load it, make it safe. If there's a safety selector switch, how to use that. So typically it's, you know, very easy to operate, and that's why people like, you know, using a firearm in sport and or self-defense.
When I was looking at some ads online, video ads for, I want to say it was the
the MCX?
Yeah, the Sig Sauer MCX, right.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been the AR-15, but I think it was the Sig Sauer. They showed a guy kind of moving through this area where there were different targets, and he was moving from point to point. Are there target places like that? Are there gun places like that where you can actually do something like that?
Oh, absolutely. One of the best ones in the nation is here in Southern Ohio, Tactical Defense Institute.
Okay.
You know, I've taken there. They have like 4 levels of rifle classes down there, and I've taken all of them. And also there's an incredible competition. It's called 3-gun competition. People use pistol, rifle, shotguns, and they maneuver through, you know, mazes like you described, shooting at different targets and sometimes metal targets. And part of it uses pistol, part of it uses shotgun, and some of it's rifle, and it's all time. So since it's so easy to use, the ammunition is economical, and it's very accurate, people tend to use those AR-style rifles for that competition.
Why is the ammo so economical?
Well, it's probably one of the smallest high-powered you know, I'm not an ammunition expert, but the smaller the bullet, the easier it is to manufacture. Like 22s are a lot cheaper than 380s, 380s, generally, or something.
I get you. It's
cheaper than
there's not a lot of material in it, and they can make a lot at once. Okay. I want to get to a call right now. Rob in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Rob.
Yeah, hi.
Hey, Rob, can I ask you a favor? Pull that phone away from your mouth a little bit.
Okay, hang on.
That's great. Thank you. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yep.
Yeah, hi. My question is I really like hearing what Clint had to say. I get pretty frustrated with people not really accurately describing semi-automatic against fully automatic weapons.
Uh-huh.
And I'm an ex-Vietnam vet, so I'm very familiar with AR-15 and AK-47s. And I've owned both guns. I don't currently own them because I sold them, but I do have a semi-automatic pistol. So the problem that I have with, we start banning semi-automatic guns in general, it impacts even semi-automatic pistols. It impacts semi-automatic hunting guns and stuff like that. And this goes to the question that I don't see that has been addressed yet. What happens when you do ban all these semi-automatic weapons and somebody goes out? In Vietnam, one of our preference weapons was an 870 Remington pump shotgun. And that is not a semi-automatic weapon. It's a hand pump shotgun that held like 8-9 rounds of 12-gauge double-op buck rounds. If a person, a criminal terrorist, is going to go into what happened, a very close confined area, a weapon of choice more than an AR-15 would have been probably a hand pump shotgun, which I think Clint or anybody would probably confirm.
Why would that be a weapon of choice? What's the advantage?
The advantage is that you have multiple, if you want to call them bullets, and if you use a double-aught buck, you have multiple bullets in one shotgun shell.
Okay.
So if it's when you fire it, you have a spread of a lot of bullets, not just one bullet coming out. You have a very wide spread. So my problem is this really going to stop criminals or terrorists? Because you ban semi-automatic weapons, you take away trap shooting, bird shooting, all the things that we use semi-automatic weapons for, and then a criminal can go out and buy a hand pump 12-gauge shotgun that is definitely used in sporting activities, and they're going to wreak more havoc and more damage.
All right.
Even a high-powered round would.
Well, I want to get Clint Lake's take on that. What's your thoughts about that, Clint Lake?
I agree. It can do horrible, horrible amounts of damage. The reason it probably isn't used as much is because after generally you have 8 to 9 rounds of double-aught buck, generally after that last round is shot, it's a slow reloading process compared to a pistol or semi-automatic, which is magazine-fed.
Right. What about the magazine size? Why is that important to not regulate? Because there have been calls for limiting the size of magazines.
The Second Amendment should not be infringed. I wonder why everybody wants, being our elected politicians, wants to modify the Second Amendment as to what's good, what's bad, and not modify things such as, well, you know, all these terrorists, they seem to have a social footprint. They seem to coordinate their efforts through the Internet. I think, you know, a correlative argument to be made to limit websites to the American people that terrorists tend to communicate through. Would that not save lives through disallowing them?
Well, not everybody who engages in a mass shooting is quote unquote a terrorist like that. I mean, wondering about the magazine size and whether or not, you know, because if you make a smaller magazine size, then you have to reload more often, and that creates moments when you could be overtaken. But it doesn't matter.
If you practice enough, and this last killer seemed to have proficient firearm skills, it could be 20, it could be a 10 round. All he has to do is
boom, boom,
pack more magazines. Yeah. He can reload very fast.
Okay. All right. Well, hey, Clint Lake, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
That's Clint Lake. He's an NRA instructor, training coordinator at Buckeye Firearms. We're talking about the automatic weapons, semi-automatic weapons used in several mass killings recently, and most recently the one in Orlando, Florida. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In 1994, the federal assault weapons ban was signed into law by President Bill Clinton, enacting a 10-year ban that expired in 2004 in the Republican-controlled Congress. That was seen as a victory for gun rights advocates. But every mass shooting in which a semi-automatic assault-style weapon has been used since, from Sandy Hook Elementary to the Aurora, Colorado movie theater to an office party in San Bernardino and now a packed nightclub in Orlando, the debate is reignited. Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton has called for a renewed ban on assault weapons in the wake of the attack, while her presumptive Republican opponent Donald Trump has blamed Muslims. But although most or even all of the 227 pieces of legislation introduced in Congress last year were related to firearms, the lack of action on the issue is not due to a lack of attention. UCLA legal scholar Adam Winkler has written about the conflict in his book. It's entitled Gunfight: The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. He joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
In a recent New York Times op-ed piece, you advocate for a no-buy list for gun purchases. We sort of hear that floated around from time to time. What would that involve?
Well, the idea is we already stop people who are suspected terrorists from boarding a plane. It's called a no-fly list. And the question is, should we have a no-buy list? Take those same suspected terrorists or some suspected terrorists who we think are likely to use guns in a terrorist act and put them on a list where when they try to buy a gun, they'll be stopped. Of course, if you're going to do something like this, this is a constitutional right, so you have to have due process protections, such as requiring an independent judiciary to sign off on the denial of the right and insisting that the government actually have some decent modicum of evidence to prove that a particular person is a threat.
You wrote that such a list was endorsed by both Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. What's been the opposition to it? Was it because it didn't get into that more explicit issue of protections?
That's right. Some of the earlier proposals and some of the continuing proposals that Congress has been considering really don't provide enough protections for people's due process rights. Either they allow the attorney general to just designate someone as a suspected terrorist without involving the courts, or if they involve the courts sometimes at the back end after someone's been denied, they still impose a very, very low burden for the attorney general that really does not protect individuals' rights.
So you say that the crux of the issue is fairness, that it can be addressed by a model found in the Fourth Amendment law on search and seizure. Can you be more explicit about how that would work?
Well, we could have a system in place where you could actually put someone on a list in advance, or you could have something that really, everyone would be on a list in advance, and you could have something that has due process protections on the front end or due process protections on the back end. The government, in compiling its list of no-buy individuals, could go to an independent court like the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Security Act court, which is designed to balance national security with individual rights, and make an argument there and present the evidence there and put someone on a list. Or you could just have anyone on a list that the government wants, and then if someone gets denied, then there's a very short time period in which someone can challenge their inclusion on that list.
You wrote that an imperfect version of a no-buy list was proposed in the Senate last year. It had tight deadline requirements. What were those, and why do those matter?
Well, they matter because it only gave the attorney general 72 hours to prove his or her case. And the truth is, we know that with government bureaucracies, with different departments having information about different people, that kind of 72-hour time limit is just too tight and probably won't be effective.
Right. So why, if that were the case, I mean, is that? But that's not what held it back, right?
Well, there are a variety of differences between Democrats and Republicans on
right.
this issue. That's one of the big differences.
All of these laws, none of them so far would impact private sales, right?
Well, if someone's on the no-fly list, the no-buy list, presumably they would be prohibited from purchasing from a private sale. It would just be very hard to know that they bought a gun in a private sale because there's no background checks, so the government would not be alerted. It would just be like someone buying something from his next-door neighbor without any filing or any government information being obtained.
Now, when we talk about the no-fly list, though the kind of extra rights you're talking about, the model found in the Fourth Amendment on law on search and seizure, those, if I'm on the no-fly list, I don't have any rights like you're talking about with a no-buy list for semi-automatic rifles.
Well, you hear that, but I just don't know that that's the case. The Supreme Court has said you do have a fundamental right to travel, to cross state lines and travel. And generally, we say, and someone could say, well, that's not really a burden on a fundamental right to have a no-fly list because you can still drive across state lines. But generally, the Supreme Court's approach to constitutional rights is not to say, oh, well, the government can ban newspapers because you have other sources of information, too. So those kinds of alternatives generally are not enough to satisfy the right to travel. Or probably the right to bear arms.
But has it been challenged at the U.S. Supreme Court level?
We have not seen a challenge at the U.S. Supreme Court level to the no-fly list. There have been challenges at lower courts. Some courts have raised significant questions with some of the no-fly lists for exactly the point that I make in my piece, which is there's insufficient due process protections.
We have an email from Lyle who says, ignorance on both sides of this issue is a major problem, but the main issue is when we say no new laws, enforce the ones we have, is that the funding is cut. The states don't participate with full effort, and the background checks and straw purchases are rampant with effectively zero consequences. What kind of laws do we have now in response to that? Adam Winkler?
Well, I think that's a very good point that your listener makes, which is that I think we ought to take the NRA seriously. They say we need to better enforce the gun laws on our books, and I completely agree with that. The problem is that the NRA has really prevented the federal government from being able to effectively enforce the gun laws on the books. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the major federal gun control agency, has really been handcuffed with insufficient number of agents, insufficient funding. Indeed, the NRA and its allies in Congress refuse to even approve a director for the agency, for the Bureau. So as a result, we don't have good, effective enforcement of our federal gun laws, and we need to do a much better job of it.
What about the issue of studying gun violence? Where did the ban on that come from?
Right. Well, we have it's not really a ban on studying gun violence. What it is a ban on the use of money from the Center for Disease Control to study, to promote studies that will advance the cause of gun control. And that came from some studies that the CDC had funded that had seemed to show support for gun control, and the NRA and its allies in Congress wanted to shut that spigot down. And they basically threatened the CDC by saying, we're going to take away all of your funding or an equivalent amount of funding that you've spent on gun control policies away from the agency. And since then, the CDC has been banned effectively from promoting gun control.
And what is the rationale that lawmakers use in Congress to do that?
Well, they say that the CDC is becoming politicized, that it's getting involved in trying to invade someone's constitutional right. It's really sad, though, because we do have a major public health problem in America. There are 30,000 people who die every year from gun violence. It is by far the most significant cause of death in America that does not receive any funding from the Center for Disease Control. We need that money to be unleashed so that we can really find out what are the right ways to go about regulating guns and reducing gun violence in a way that doesn't infringe our right to bear arms.
Right, because the CDC studied like seatbelt use, for example.
That's right. The CDC is one of the most important funders of research into public health problems in America, from cancer to various kinds of accidents that might happen. Center for Disease Control is really a really important player, but it hasn't been an important player in the gun world because the NRA and some of its allies have really tried to shut off research into this issue.
We have an email from John. He says, Congress won't act because of the gun lobby, but the majority of public opinion favors such a ban. He asks, is it feasible to have a public referendum for an assault weapon ban? You can't. I don't know. I know you can't do it in Ohio at the local level because the states banned it. But could states do that? Have you ever heard about anything like that? Adam Winkler?
Sure, you could regulate guns through a referendum or initiative if you couldn't get it through the legislative process. In a state like my home state in California, we have an initiative and referendum approach that, you know, if you satisfy the demands, the procedural requirements to get something on the ballot, you could certainly propose a ban on assault weapons. I don't think that particular law is the right way to go. I think it's kind of a distraction in the gun debate, but nonetheless, that would be one method that you could use to get around obstinate lawmakers.
Why do you think it's not the right way to go?
I don't, you know, assault weapons are rarely used in criminal activity. They're responsible for less than 300 of the 30,000 people who die every year from gun violence. And the thing that people really don't like about these weapons is not the rifle itself, but the high-capacity magazine. And you could have a high-capacity magazine on a handgun, too. If you want to talk about banning high-capacity magazines, that's a different conversation. But banning one particular type of weapon is kind of like trying to reduce drunk driving by outlawing scotch. It's really not going to work because people have so many other easy substitutes for scotch. Drunk driving's not really going to be affected.
Dan in Grove City, you're on the air. Hi, Dan.
How's it going? I would like to talk about, similar to what our expert is talking about, how banning one type of rifle is not going to be making any sort of difference. A lot of times here in the gun community, I've been involved in with firearms for many years. We talk about how assault rifles are stigmatized due to just how they look. We often call them scary black rifles because the media has portrayed them in such a way that they are more deadly or more powerful than other types of rifles.
Kind of like the pit bull for dogs.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, all rifles are semi-automatic with the exception of bolt-action rifles. So what's the difference between the color and the aesthetic of the rifle in correlation to its dangerousness?
Dan, I want to ask you, as you're a gun enthusiast, I assume, what do you think about the no buy list, enacting some form of that?
I feel that that could be a solution to the problems we are facing. However, I think there's a blurry line there because I have had friends who have been denied, you know, for purchasing firearms for no reasons other than, you know, they have made, you know, some small mistake in their past. And, you know, when they go to buy a firearm, they are denied. And, you know, in which case they really should not have been.
Okay.
So I think it can help. But ultimately, I think we need to be very careful with how far we go with those measures.
Okay. Dan, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you so much.
Adam Winkler, what's your prediction as a scholar on this issue of the right to bear arms in the United States? What is your prediction about what it'll take, what it might take, what might happen?
Well, that's the kind of question that certainly Yogi Berra was thinking about when he said, it's tough making predictions, especially about the future. you know, trying to predict where the gun debate is going is a really tough one. I don't think we're going to have a lot of movement this year. It's an election year, and obviously things are very heated between the two political parties. Guns are one of the most contentious issues in America. I do think that the guns are going to play an important role in this election, and the Democrats and the Republicans are going to take very different positions on gun control and really talk about those different positions. It may be that the presidential election of 2016 is in some ways a referendum on gun control.
Interesting. And as far as the popularity of guns, do you see that ebbing? From what I'm understanding in my research, they're more popular than ever, particularly these rifles like the AR-15, the AK-47, all of these kinds of rifles. They're really, really popular. People love them.
Well, these particular rifles are definitely the most popular rifles in America today. They're easy to use, highly customizable. People who are gun enthusiasts and who shoot really like to shoot these guns.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to say whether guns are becoming more popular as a general matter in America.
Okay.
Certainly gun sales are up. There's about 20 million last year gun sales in America, so that's a huge number. At the same time, the studies continually show that the percentage of households that have guns is going down.
Interesting. Well, Adam Winkler, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again for having me.
Adam Winkler is a professor at the UCLA School of Law and the author of a book entitled Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.